But, of course, he went down to Havner, Southport, in one of his father's carts, driven by one of his father's carters, along with Master Hemlock. As a rule, people do what wizards advise them to do, and it is no small honor to be invited by a wizard to be his student or apprentice. Hemlock, who had won his staff on Roke, was used to having boys come to him begging to be tested and, if they had the gift for it, taught. He was a little curious about this boy, whose cheerful good manners hid some reluctance or self-doubt. It was the father's idea, not the boy's, that he was gifted. That was unusual, though perhaps not so unusual among the wealthy as among common folk. At any rate, he came with a very good prenticing fee paid beforehand in gold and ivory. If he had the makings of a wizard, Hemlock would train him. And if he had, as Hemlock suspected, a mere childish flair, then he'd be sent home with what remained of his fee. Hemlock was an honest, upright, humorless, scholarly wizard with little interest in feelings or ideas. His gift was for names. "The art begins and ends in naming," he said, which indeed is true, although there may be a good deal between the beginning and the end. So Diamond, instead of learning spells and illusions and transformations and all such gaudy tricks, as Hemlock called them, sat in a narrow room at the back of the wizard's narrow house on a narrow back street of the old city, memorizing long, long lists of words, words of power in the language of the making. Plants and parts of plants, and animals and parts of animals, and islands and parts of islands, parts of ships, parts of the human body. The words never made sense, never made sentences, only lists. Long, long lists. His mind wandered. "Eyelash in the true speech is siasta," he read, and he felt eyelashes brush his cheek in a butterfly kiss, dark lashes. He looked up startled and did not know what had touched him. Later, when he tried to repeat the word, he stood dumb. "Memory, memory," Hemlock said. "Talent's no good without memory." He was not harsh, but he was unyielding. Diamond had no idea what opinion Hemlock had of him, and guessed it to be pretty low. The wizard sometimes had him come with him to his work, mostly laying spells of safety on ships and houses, purifying wells, and sitting on the councils of the city, seldom speaking but always listening. Another wizard, not Roke-trained but with the healer's gift, looked after the sick and dying of Southport. Hemlock was glad to let him do so. His own pleasure was in studying, and as far as Diamond could see, doing no magic at all. "Keep the equilibrium, it's all in that," Hemlock said, "and knowledge, order, and control." Those words he said so often that they made a tune in Diamond's head and sang themselves over and over. Knowledge, order, and control. When Diamond put the lists of names to tunes he made up, he learned them much faster. But then the tune would come as part of the name, and he would sing out so clearly, for his voice had reestablished itself as a strong, dark tenor, that Hemlock winced. Hemlock's was a very silent house. Mostly the pupil was supposed to be with the master, or studying the lists of names in the room where the lore books and word books were, or asleep. Hemlock was a stickler for early abed and early afoot, but now and then Diamond had an hour or two free. He always went down to the dock, and sat on a pier side or a water stair, and thought about Dark Rose. As soon as he was out of the house and away from Master Hemlock, he began to think about Dark Rose, and went on thinking about her and very little else. It surprised him a little. He thought he ought to be homesick, to think about his mother. He did think about his mother quite often, and often was homesick, lying on his cot in his bare and narrow little room, after a scanty supper of cold pea porridge, for this wizard at least did not live in such luxury as Golden had imagined. Diamond never thought about Dark Rose nights. He thought of his mother, or of sunny rooms and hot food, or a tune would come into his head and he would practice it mentally on the harp in his mind and so drift off to sleep. Dark Rose would come to his mind only when he was down at the dock, staring out at the water of the harbor, the piers, the fishing boats, only when he was outdoors and away from Hemlock and his house. So he cherished his free hours as if they were actual meetings with her. He had always loved her, but had not understood that he loved her beyond anyone and anything. When he was with her, even when he was down on the docks thinking of her, he was alive. He never felt entirely alive in Master Hemlock's house and presence. He felt a little dead. Not dead, but a little dead. A few times, sitting on the water stairs, the dirty harbor water sloshing at the next step down, the yells of gulls and dock workers wreathing the air with a thin, ungainly music, he shut his eyes and saw his love so clear, so close, that he reached out his hand to touch her. If he reached out his hand in his mind only, as when he played the mental harp, then indeed he touched her. He felt her hand in his, and her cheek, warm, cool, silken gritty, lay against his mouth. In his mind he spoke to her, and in his mind she answered, her voice, her husky voice, saying his name, Diamond. But as he went back up the streets of Southport, he lost her. He swore to keep her with him, to think of her, that night, but she faded away. By the time he opened the door of Master Hemlock's house, he was reciting lists of names, or wondering what would be for dinner, for he was hungry most of the time. Not till he could take an hour and run back down to the docks could he think of her. So he came to feel that those hours were true meetings with her, and he lived for them. Without knowing what he lived for until his feet were on the cobbles and his eyes on the harbor and the far line of the sea. Then he remembered what was worth remembering. The winter passed by, and the cold early spring, and with the warm late spring came a letter from his mother, brought by a carter. Diamond read it and took it to Master Hemlock, saying, "My mother wonders if I might spend a month at home this summer." "Probably not," the wizard said. And then, appearing to notice Diamond, put down his pen and said, "Young man, I must ask you if you wish to continue studying with me." Diamond had no idea what to say. The idea of its being up to him had not occurred to him. "Do you think I ought to?" he asked at last. "Probably not," the wizard said. Diamond expected to feel relieved, released, but found he felt rejected, ashamed. "I'm sorry," he said, with enough dignity that Hemlock glanced up at him. "You could go to Roke," the wizard said. "To Roke?" The boy's drop-jawed stare irritated Hemlock, though he knew it shouldn't. Wizards aren't used to overweening confidence in the young of their kind. They expect modesty to come later, if at all. "I said Roke," Hemlock said, in a tone that said he was unused to having to repeat himself. And then because this boy, this soft-headed, spoiled, moony boy, had endeared himself to Hemlock by his uncomplaining patience, he took pity on him and said, "You should either go to Roke or find a wizard to teach you what you need. Of course, you need what I can teach you. You need the names. The art begins and ends in naming, but that's not your gift. You have a poor memory for words. You must train it diligently. However, it's clear that you do have capacities, and that they need cultivation and discipline, which another man can give you better than I can." So does modesty breed modesty sometimes, even in unlikely places. "If you were to go to Roke, I'd send a letter with you, drawing you to the particular attention of the Master Summoner." "Oh," the Diamond, "Lord." The Summoner's art is perhaps the most arcane and dangerous of all the arts of magic. "Perhaps I am wrong," said Hemlock in his dry, flat voice. "Your gift may be for pattern, or perhaps it's an ordinary gift for shaping and transformation. I'm not certain. But you are, I do actually, oh, yes. You are uncommonly slow, young man, to recognize your own capacities." It was spoken harshly, and Diamond stiffened up a bit. "I thought my gift was for music," he said. Hemlock dismissed that with a flick of his hand. "I am talking of the true art," he said. "Now I will be frank with you. I advise you to write your parents. I shall write them too, informing them of your decision to go to the school on Roke, if that is what you decide, or to the great port, if the mage Restive will take you on, as I think he will with my recommendation. But I advise against visiting home The entanglement of family, friends, and so on is precisely what you need to be free of, now and henceforth. Do wizards have no family? Hemlock was glad to see a bit of fire in the boy. They are one another's family, he said. And no friends? They may be friends. Did I say it was an easy life? A pause. Hemlock looked directly at Diamond. There was a girl, he said. Diamond met his gaze for a moment, looked down, and said nothing. Your father told me. A witch's daughter. A childhood playmate. He believed that you had taught her spells. She taught me, Hemlock nodded. That is quite understandable among children and quite impossible now. Do you understand that? No, Diamond said. Sit down, said Hemlock. After a moment, Diamond took a stiff, high-backed chair facing him. I can protect you here, and have done so. On Roke, of course, you'll be perfectly safe. The very walls there. But if you go home, you must be willing to protect yourself. It's a difficult thing for a young man, very difficult. A test of a will that has not yet been steeled, a mind that has not yet seen its true goal. I very strongly advise that you not take that risk. Write your parents, and go to the great port, or to Roke. Half your year's fee, which I'll return to you, will see your first expenses. Diamond sat upright and still. He had been getting some of his father's height and girth lately, and looked very much a man, though a very young one. What did you mean, Master Hemlock, in saying that you had protected me here? Simply as I protect myself, the wizard said. And after a moment, testily, the bargain, boy. The power we give for our power. The lesser state of being we forego. Surely you know that every true man of power is celibate. There was a pause, and Diamond said, so you saw to it that I... Of course. It was my responsibility as your teacher. Diamond nodded. He said, thank you. Presently he stood up. Excuse me, Master, he said. I have to think. Where are you going? Down to the waterfront. Better stay here. I can't think here. Hemlock might have known then what he was up against. But having told the boy he would not be his master any longer, he could not in conscience command him. You have a true gift, Asiri, he said, using the name he had given the boy in the springs of the Amia, a word that in the old speech means willow. I don't entirely understand it. I think you don't understand it at all. Take care. To misuse a gift or to refuse to use it may cause great loss, great harm. Diamond nodded, suffering, contrite, unrebellious, unmovable. Go on, the wizard said, and he went. Later he knew he should never have let the boy leave the house. He had underestimated Diamond's willpower, or the strength of the spell the girl had laid on him. Their conversation was in the morning. Hemlock went back to the ancient cantrip he was annotating. It was not until supper time that he thought about his pupil, and not until he had eaten supper alone that he admitted that Diamond had run away. Hemlock was loath to practice any of the lesser arts of magic. He did not put out a finding spell, as any sorcerer might have done, nor did he call to Diamond in any way. He was angry. Perhaps he was hurt. He had thought well of the boy, and offered to write the summoner about him, and then, at the first test of character, Diamond had broken. Glass, the wizard muttered. At least this weakness proved he was not dangerous. Some talents were best not left to run wild, for there was no harm in this fellow, no malice, no ambition, no spine, said Hemlock to the silence of the house. Let him crawl home to his mother. Still it rankled him that Diamond had let him down flat, without a word of thanks or apology. So much for good manners, he thought. As she blew out the lamp and got into bed, the witch's daughter heard an owl calling, the little liquid woo-hoo-hoo that made people call them laughing owls. She heard it with a mournful heart. That had been their signal summer nights when they sneaked out to meet in the willow grove, down on the banks of the Amia, when everybody else was sleeping. She would not think of him at night. Back in the winter, She had sent to him night after night. She had learned her mother's spell of sending and knew that it was a true spell. She had sent him her touch, her voice, saying his name again and again. She had met a wall of air and silence. She touched nothing. He would not hear. Once or twice, all of a sudden, in the daytime, there had been a moment when she had known him close in mind and could touch him if she reached out. But at night, she knew only his blank presence, his refusal of her. She had stopped trying to reach him months ago, but her heart was still very sore. "Hoo-hoo," said the owl under her window. And then it said, "Dark Rose." Startled from her misery, she leaped out of bed and opened the shutters. "Come on out," whispered Diamond, a shadow in the starlight. "Mother's not home. Come in." She met him at the door. They held each other tight, hard, silent for a long time. To Diamond, it was as if he held his future, his own life, his whole life, in his arms. At last she moved and kissed his cheek and whispered, "I missed you, I missed you, I missed you. How long can you stay?" "As long as I like." She kept his hand and led him in. He was always a little reluctant to enter the witch's house, a pungent, disorderly place thick with the mysteries of women and witchcraft. Very different from his own clean, comfortable home, even more different from the cold austerity of the wizard's house. Shivered like a horse as he stood there, too tall for the herb-festooned rafters. He was very highly strung and worn out, having walked 40 miles in 16 hours without food. "Where's your mother?" he asked in a whisper. "Sitting with old Fernie. She died this afternoon. Mother will be there all night." "But how did you get here?"
"Walked."
"The wizard let you visit home?"
"I ran away."
"Ran away? Why?"
"To keep you."
He looked at her, that vivid, fierce, dark face in its rough cloud of hair. She wore only her shift, and he saw the infinitely delicate, tender rise of her breast. He drew her to him again, but though she hugged him, she drew away again, frowning.
"Keep me?" she repeated. "You didn't seem to worry about losing me all winter. What made you come back now?"
"He wanted me to go to Roke."
"To Roke?"
She stared.
"To Roke, Di? Then you really do have the gift. You could be a sorcerer."
To find her on Hemlock's side was a blow. "Sorcerers are nothing to him. He means I could be a wizard, do magery, not just witchcraft."
"Oh, I see,"
Rose said after a moment. "But I don't see why you ran away." They had let go of each other's hands. "Don't you understand?" he said, exasperated with her for not understanding because he had not understood. "A wizard can't have anything to do with women, with witches, with all that."
"Oh, I know. It's beneath them. It's not just beneath them. Oh, but it is. I'll bet you had to unlearn every spell I taught you, didn't you? It isn't the same kind of thing. No, it isn't the high art. It isn't the true speech. A wizard mustn't soil his lips with common words. Weak as women's magic, wicked as women's magic. You think I don't know what they say? So why did you come back here?"
"To see you."
"What for? What do you think? You never sent to me. You never let me send to you. All the time you were gone, I was just supposed to wait until you got tired of playing wizard. Well, I got tired of waiting."
Her voice was nearly inaudible, a rough whisper.
"Somebody's been coming around," he said, incredulous that she could turn against him. "Who's been after you?" "None of your business if there is.
You go off, you turn your back on me. Wizards can't have anything to do with what I do, what my mother does."
"Well, I don't want anything to do with what you do either, ever, so go."
Starving, hungry, frustrated, misunderstood, Diamond reached out to hold her again, to make her body understand his body, repeating that first deep embrace that had held all the years of their lives in it. He found himself standing 2 feet back, his hands stinging and his ears ringing and his eyes dazzled. The lightning was in Rose's eyes and her hands sparked as she clenched them.
"Never do that again," she whispered.
"Never fear," Diamond said. turned on his heel and strode out. A string of dried sage caught on his head and trailed after him. He spent the night in their old place in the Sallows. Maybe he hoped she would come, but she did not come, and he soon slept in sheer weariness. He woke in the first cold light. He sat up and thought. He looked at life in that cold light. It was a different matter from what he had believed it. He went down to the stream in which he had been named. He drank, washed his hands and face, made himself look as decent as he could, and went up through the town to the fine house at the high end, his father's house. After the first outcries and embraces, the servants and his mother sat him right down to breakfast. So it was with warm food in his belly and a certain chill courage in his heart that he faced his father, who had been out before breakfast seeing off a string of timber carts to the great port. "Well, son," they touched cheeks. "So Master Hemlock gave you a vacation?"
"No, sir, I left."
Golden stared, then filled his plate and sat down. "Left," he said. "Yes, sir, I decided that I don't want to be a wizard."
"Hmph,"
said Golden, chewing. "Left of your own accord?"
"Entirely."
"With the master's permission?"
"Of my own accord entirely, without his permission."
Golden chewed very slowly, his eyes on the table. Diamond had seen his father look like this when a forester reported an infestation in the chestnut groves, and when he found a mule dealer had cheated him. "He wanted me to go to the college on Roke to study with the master summoner. He was going to send me there. I decided not to go." After a while, Golden asked, still looking at the table, "Why?"
"It isn't the life I want."
Another pause. Golden glanced over at his wife, who stood by the window listening in silence. Then he looked at his son. Slowly the mixture of anger, disappointment, confusion, and respect on his face gave way to something simpler. A look of complicity, very nearly a wink.
"I see," he said.
"And what did you decide you want?"
A pause.
"This," Diamond said. His voice was level. He looked neither at his father nor his mother.
"Ha!" said Golden. "Well, I will say I'm glad of it, son." He ate a small pork pie in one mouthful. "Being a wizard, going to Roke, all that, it never seemed real, not exactly. And with you off there, I didn't know what all this was for, to tell you the truth, all my business. If you're here, it adds up, you see. It adds up.
Well, but listen here. Did you just run off from the wizard? Did he know you were going?"
"No, I'll write him," Diamond said, in his new, level voice.
"He won't be angry. They say wizards have short tempers, full of pride."
"He's angry," Diamond said, "but he won't do anything."
So it proved. Indeed, to Golden's amazement, Master Hemlock sent back a scrupulous 2/5 of the prenticing fee. With the packet, which was delivered by one of Golden's carters who had taken a load of spars down to Southport, was a note for Diamond. It said, "True art requires a single heart." The direction on the outside was the Hardic rune for willow. The note was signed with Hemlock's rune, which had two meanings: the hemlock tree and suffering. Diamond sat in his own sunny room upstairs on his comfortable bed, hearing his mother singing as she went about the house. He held the wizard's letter and reread the message and the two runes many times. The cold and sluggish mind that had been born in him that morning down in the Sallows accepted the lesson. No magic. Never again. He had never given his heart to it. It had been a game to him, a game to play with Dark Rose. Even the names of the true speech that he had learned in the wizard's house, though he knew the beauty and the power that lay in them, he could let go, let slip, forget. That was not his language. He could speak his language only with her, and he had lost her, let her go. The double heart has no true speech. From now on he could talk only the language of duty, the getting and the spending, the outlay and the income, the profit and the loss. And beyond that, nothing. There had been illusions, little spells, pebbles that turned to butterflies, wooden birds that flew on living wings for a minute or two. There had never been a choice, really. There was only one way for him to go. Golden was immensely happy, and quite unconscious of it. "Old man's got his jewel back," said the carter to the forester. "Sweet as new butter he is." Golden, unaware of being sweet, thought only how sweet life was. He had bought the wretchy grove at a very stiff price, to be sure, but at least old Low Bow of East Hill hadn't got it, and now he and Diamond could develop it as it ought to be developed. In among the chestnuts there were a lot of pines, which could be felled and sold for masts and spars and small lumber, and replanted with chestnut seedlings. It would in time be a pure stand, like the big grove, the heart of his chestnut kingdom. In time, of course. Oak and chestnut don't shoot up overnight like alder and willow. But there was time. There was time now. The boy was barely 17, and he himself just 45, in his prime. He had been feeling old, but that was nonsense. He was in his prime. The oldest trees, past bearing, ought to come out with the pines. Some good wood for furniture could be salvaged from them. "Well, well, well," he said to his wife frequently. "All rosy again, eh? Got the apple of your eye back home, eh? No more moping, eh?" And Tuli smiled and stroked his hand. Once, instead of smiling and agreeing, she said, "It's lovely to have him back, but..." And Golden stopped hearing. Mothers were born to worry about their children, and women were born never to be content. There was no reason why he should listen to the litany of anxieties by which Tuli hauled herself through life. Of course, she thought a merchant's life wasn't good enough for the boy. She'd have thought being king in Havnor wasn't good enough for him. "When he gets himself a girl," Golden said, in answer to whatever it was she had been saying, "he'll be all squared away. Living with the wizards, you know, the way they are, it set him back a bit. Don't worry about Diamond. He'll know what he wants when he sees it."
"I hope so," said Tuli.
"At least he's not seeing the witch girl," said Golden. "That's done with." Later on it occurred to him that neither was his wife seeing the witch anymore. For years they'd been thick as thieves, against all his warnings, and now Tangle was never anywhere near the house. Women's friendships never lasted. He teased her about it, finding her strewing pennyroyal and miller's bane in the chests and clothes presses against an infestation of moths. He said, "Seems like you'd have your friend, the wise woman, up to hex 'em away. Or aren't you friends anymore?"
"No," his wife said in her soft, level voice. "We aren't."
"And a good thing, too," Golden said roundly. "What's become of that daughter of hers, then? Went off with a juggler, I heard."
"A musician," Tuli said. "Last summer."
"A name day party," said Golden. "Time for a bit of play, a bit of music and dancing, boy. 19 years old, celebrate it." "I'll be going to East Hill with Sul's mules." "No, no, no. Sul can handle it. Stay home and have your party. You've been working hard. We'll hire a band. Who's the best in the country? Tarry and his lot?"
"Father, I don't want a party," Diamond said, and stood up, shivering his muscles like a horse.
He was bigger than Golden now, and when he moved abruptly it was startling.
"I'll go to East Hill," he said, and left the room.
"What's that all about?" Golden said to his wife, a rhetorical question. She looked at him and said nothing, a non-rhetorical answer. After Golden had gone out, she found her son in the counting room going through ledgers. She looked at the pages, long, long lists of names and numbers, debts and credits, profits and losses.
"Die," she said, and he looked up.
His face was still round and a bit peachy, though the bones were heavier and the eyes were melancholy.
"I didn't mean to hurt Father's feelings," he said.
"If he wants a party, he'll have it," she said.
Their voices were alike, being in the higher register but dark-toned, and held to an even quietness, contained, restrained.
She perched on a stool beside his at the high desk.
"I can't," he said, and stopped,
and went on. "I really don't want to have any dancing."
"He's matchmaking," Tuli said, dry, fond. "I don't care about that. I know you don't." "The problem is..."
"The problem is the music," his mother said at last. He nodded.
"My son, there is no reason," she said, suddenly passionate. "There is no reason why you should give up everything you love.
He took her hand and kissed it as they sat side by side.
"Things don't mix," he said. "They ought to, but they don't.
I found that out. When I left the wizard, I thought I could be everything. You know, do magic, play music, be father, son, love Rose. It doesn't work that way. Things don't mix."
They do," Tuli said.
"Everything is hooked together, tangled up. Maybe things are for women. But I can't be double-hearted."
"Double-hearted? You
gave up wizardry because you knew that if you didn't, you'd betray it." He took the word with a visible shock, but did not deny it.
"But why did you give up music?"
"I have to have a single heart. I can't play the harp while I'm bargaining with a mule breeder. I can't sing ballads while I'm figuring what we have to pay the pickers to keep him from hiring out to Lobau." His voice shook a little now, a vibrato, and his eyes were not sad, but angry. "So you put a spell on yourself," she said, "just as that wizard put one on you, a spell to keep you safe, to keep you with the mule breeders and the nut pickers and these." She struck the ledger full of lists of names and figures, a flicking, dismissive tap.
"A spell of silence," she said.
After a long time, the young man said, "What else can I do?"
"I don't know, my dear. I do want you to be safe. I do love to see your father happy and proud of you. But I can't bear to see you unhappy, without pride. I don't know, maybe you're right. Maybe for a man it's only one thing ever. But I miss hearing you sing." He was in tears.
They hugged, and she stroked his thick, shining hair and apologized for being cruel, and he hugged her again and said she was the kindest mother in the world, and so she went off. But as she left, she turned back a moment and said,
"Let him have the party, Di. Let yourself have it."
"I will," he said, to comfort her. Golden ordered the beer and food and fireworks, but Diamond saw to hiring the musicians. "Of course I'll bring my band," Tarry said. "Fat chance I'd miss it. You'll have every tootler in the west of the world here for one of your dad's parties. You can't tell him you're the band that's getting paid." "Oh, they'll come for the glory," said the harper, a lean, long-jawed, wall-eyed fellow of 40. "Maybe you'll have a go with us yourself, then. You had a hand for it before you took to making money, and the voice not bad if you'd worked on it."
"I doubt it," Diamond said.
"The girl you liked, which is Rose. She's running about with Labby, I hear. No doubt they'll come by."
"I'll see you then," said Diamond, looking big and handsome and indifferent, and walked off.
"Too high and mighty these days to stop and talk," said Tarry. "Thought I taught him all he knows of harping. But what's that to a rich man?" Tarry's malice had left his nerves raw, and the thought of the party weighed on him till he lost his appetite. He thought hopefully for a while that he was sick and could miss the party. But the day came, and he was there. Not so evidently, so eminently, so flamboyantly there as his father, but present, smiling, dancing. All his childhood friends were there, too, half of them married by now to the other half, it seemed. But there was still plenty of flirting going on, and several pretty girls were always near him. He drank a good deal of Gadge Brewer's excellent beer and found he could endure the music if he was dancing to it, and talking and laughing while he danced. So he danced with all the pretty girls in turn, and then again with whichever one turned up again, which all of them did. It was Golden's grandest party yet, with a dancing floor built on the town green down the way from Golden's house, and a tent for the old folks to eat and drink and gossip in, and new clothes for the children, and jugglers and puppeteers, some of them hired and some of them coming by to pick up whatever they could in the way of coppers and free beer. Any festivity drew itinerant entertainers and musicians. It was their living, and though uninvited, they were welcomed. A tale singer with a droning voice and a droning bagpipe was singing The Deed of the Dragon Lord to a group of people under the big oak on the hilltop. When Tarry's band of harp, fife, viol, and drum took time off for a breather and a swig, a new group hopped up onto the dance floor. "Hey, there's Labby's band," cried the pretty girl nearest Diamond. "Come on, they're the best." Labby, a light-skinned, flashy-looking fellow, played the double-reed woodhorn. With him were a violist, a tabor player, and Rose, who played fife. Their first tune was a stampy, fast and brilliant, too fast for some of the dancers. Diamond and his partner stayed in, and people cheered and clapped them when they finished the dance, sweating and panting. "Beer!" Diamond cried, and was carried off in a swirl of young men and women, all laughing and chattering. He heard behind him the next tune start up, the viol alone, strong and sad as a tenor voice, "Where My Love Is Going." He drank a mug of beer down in one draught, and the girls with him watched the muscles in his strong throat as he swallowed, and they laughed and chattered, and he shivered all over like a cart horse stung by flies. He said, "Oh, I can't." He bolted off into the dusk beyond the lanterns hanging around the brewer's booth. "Where's he going?" said one, and another, "He'll be back," and they laughed and chattered. The tune ended. "Dark Rose," he said, behind her in the dark. She turned her head and looked at him. Their heads were on a level, she sitting cross-legged up on the dance platform, he kneeling on the grass. "Come to the sallows," he said. She said nothing. Labby, glancing at her, set his woodhorn to his lips. The drummer struck a triple beat on his tabor, and they were off into a sailor's jig. When she looked around again, Diamond was gone. Tarry came back with his band in an hour or so, ungrateful for the respite, and much the worse for beer. He interrupted the tune and the dancing, telling Labby loudly to clear out. "Ah, pick your nose, harp picker," Labby said, and Tarry took offense, and people took sides, and while the dispute was at its brief height, Rose put her fife in her pocket and slipped away. Away from the lanterns of the party it was dark, but she knew the way in the dark. He was there. The willows had grown these 2 years. There was only a little space to sit among the green shoots and the long falling leaves. The music started up, distant, blurred by wind and the murmur of the river running. "What did you want, Diamond?" "To talk." They were only voices and shadows to each other. "So," she said. "I wanted to ask you to go away with me," he said.
"When?"
"Then, when we quarreled. I said it all wrong. I thought..."
A long pause.
"I thought I could go on running away, with you, and play music, make a living, together. I meant to say that."
"You didn't say it."
"I know. I said everything wrong. I did everything wrong. I betrayed everything. The magic, and the music, and you."
"I'm all right," she said.
"Are you?" "I'm not really good on the fife, but I'm good enough. What you didn't teach me, I can fill in with a spell if I have to. And the band, they're all right. Labby isn't as bad as he looks. Nobody fools with me. We make a pretty good living. Winters, I go stay with Mother and help her out, so I'm all right. What about you, Di?"
"All wrong."
She started to say something and did not say it. "I guess we were children," he said.
"Now, what's changed?"
"I made the wrong choice."
"Once," she said, "or twice?"
"Twice. Third time's the charm." Neither spoke for a while. She could just make out the bulk of him in the leafy shadows. "You're bigger than you were," she said. "Can you still make a light, Di? I want to see you." He shook his head. "That was the one thing you could do that I never could, and you never could teach me. I didn't know what I was doing," he said. "Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't." "And the wizard in Southport didn't teach you how to make it work?" "He only taught me names." "Why can't you do it now?" "I gave it up, Dark Rose. I had to either do it and nothing else, or not do it. You have to have a single heart."
"I don't see why," she said.
"My mother can cure a fever and ease childbirth and find a lost ring. Now, maybe that's nothing compared to what the wizards and the dragon lords can do, but it's not nothing all the same. And she didn't give up anything for it. Having me didn't stop her. She had me so that she could learn how to do it. Just because I learned how to play music from you, did I have to give up saying spells? I can bring a fever down now, too. Why should you have to stop doing one thing so you can do the other?" "My father," he began, and stopped, and gave a kind of laugh. "They don't go together," he said. "The money and the music." "The father and the witch girl," said Dark Rose. Again there was a silence between them. The leaves of the willows stirred. "Would you come back to me?" he said. "Would you go with me, live with me, marry me, Dark Rose?" "Not in your father's house, Di. Anywhere, run away. But you can't have me without the music. Or the music without you." "I would," she said. "Does Labby want a harper?" She hesitated. She laughed. "If he wants a fife player," she said. "I haven't practiced ever since I left, Dark Rose," he said. "But the music was always in my head, and you..." She reached out her hands to him. They knelt, facing, the willow leaves moving across their hair. They kissed each other, timidly at first. In the years after Diamond left home, Golden made more money than he had ever done before. All his deals were profitable. It was as if good fortune stuck to him and he could not shake it off. He grew immensely wealthy. He did not forgive his son. It would have made a happy ending, but he would not have it. To leave so without a word on his name day night, to go off with the witch girl, leaving all the honest work undone, to be a vagrant musician, a harper twanging and singing and grinning for pennies, there was nothing but shame and pain and anger in it for Golden. So he had his tragedy. Tuli shared it with him for a long time, since she could see her son only by lying to her husband, which she found hard to do. She wept to think of Diamond, hungry, sleeping hard. Cold nights of autumn were a misery to her. But as time went on, and she heard him spoken of as Diamond, the sweet singer of the west of Havnor, Diamond who had harped and sung to the great lords in the Tower of the Sword, her heart grew lighter. And once, when Golden was down at Southport, she and Tangle took a donkey cart and drove over to East Hill, where they heard Diamond sing the Lay of the Lost Queen, while Rose sat with them, and little Tuli sat on Tuli's knee. And if not a happy ending, that was a true joy, which may be enough to ask for after all.
The Bones of the Earth. It was raining again. The Wizard of Ray Albi was sorely tempted to make a weather spell. Just a little small spell to send the rain on round the mountain. His bones ached. They ached for the sun to come out and shine through his flesh and dry them out. Of course, he could say a pain spell, but all that would do was hide the ache for a while. There was no cure for what ailed him. Old bones need the sun. The wizard stood still in the doorway of his house between the dark room and the rain-streaked open air, preventing himself from making a spell, and angry at himself for preventing himself and for having to be prevented. He never swore. Men of power do not swear. It isn't safe. But he cleared his throat with a coughing growl like a bear. A moment later, a thunderclap rolled off the hidden upper slopes of Gaunt Mountain, echoing round from north to south, dying away in the cloud-filled forest. A good sign, thunder, Dulce thought. It would stop raining soon. He pulled up his hood and went out into the rain to feed the chickens. He checked the hen house, finding 3 eggs. Red Bucca was setting. Her eggs were about due to hatch. The mites were bothering her, and she looked scruffy and jaded. He said a few words against mites, told himself to remember to clean out the nest box as soon as the chicks hatched, and went on to the poultry yard, where Brown Bucca and Gray and Leggings and Candor and the King huddled under the eaves, making soft, shrewish remarks about rain. "It'll stop by midday," the wizard told the chickens. He fed them and squelched back to the house with 3 warm eggs. When he was a child, he had liked to walk in mud. He remembered enjoying the cool of it rising between his toes. He still liked to go barefoot, but no longer enjoyed mud. It was sticky stuff, and he disliked stooping to clean his feet before going into the house. When he'd had a dirt floor, it hadn't mattered, but now he had a wooden floor like a lord or a merchant or an archmage, to keep the cold and damp out of his bones. Not his own notion. Silence had come up from Gauntport last spring to lay a floor in the old house. They had had one of their arguments about it. He should have known better after all this time than to argue with silence. "I walked on dirt for 75 years, Dulcet said. "A few more won't kill me." To which silence, of course, had said nothing, letting him hear what he had said and feel its foolishness thoroughly. "Dirt's easier to keep clean," he said, knowing the struggle already lost. It was true that all you had to do with a good, hard-packed clay floor was sweep it and now and then sprinkle it to keep the dust down, but it sounded silly all the same. "Who's to lay this floor?" he said, now merely querulous. Silence nodded, meaning himself. The boy was, in fact, a workman of the first order, carpenter, cabinet maker, stone layer, roofer. He had proved that when he lived up here as Dulce's student, and his life with the rich folk of Gauntport had not softened his hand. He brought the boards from Sixth's mill in Ray Albee, driving Gammer's ox team. He laid the floor and polished it the next day, while the old wizard was up at Bog Lake gathering simples. When Dulce came home, there it was, shining like a dark lake itself. "I have to wash my feet every time I come in," he grumbled. He walked in gingerly. The wood was so smooth it seemed soft to the bare sole. "Satin," he said. "You didn't do all that in one day without a spell or two. A village hut with a palace floor. Well, it'll be a sight come winter to see the fire shine in that. Or do I have to get me a carpet now? A fleece fell on a golden warp." Silence smiled. He was pleased with himself. He had turned up on Dulce's doorstep a few years ago. Well, no, 20 years ago, it must be 25. A while ago now. He had been truly a boy then, long-legged, rough-haired, soft-faced, a set mouth, clear-eyed. "What do you want?" the wizard had asked, knowing what he wanted, what they all wanted, and keeping his eyes from those clear eyes. He was a good teacher, the best on Gaunt, he knew that, but he was tired of teaching and didn't want another prentice underfoot and sensed danger. "To learn," the boy whispered. "Go to Roke," the wizard said. The boy wore shoes and a good leather vest. He could afford or earn ship's passage to the school. "I've been there." At that, Dulce looked him over again. No cloak, no staff. "Failed? Sent away? Ran away?" The boy shook his head at each question. He shut his eyes. His mouth was already shut. He stood there, intensely gathered, suffering, drew breath, looked straight into the wizard's eyes. "My mastery is here, on Gaunt," he said, still speaking hardly above a whisper. "My master is Enhemon." At that, the wizard, whose true name was Enhemon, stood as still as he did, looking back at him, till the boy's gaze dropped. In silence, Dulce thought his name and saw two things, a fir cone and the rune of the closed mouth. Then, seeking further, he heard in his mind a name spoken, but he did not speak it. "I'm tired of teaching and talking," he said. "I need silence. Is that enough for you?" The boy nodded once. "Then to me you are silence," the wizard said. "You can sleep in the nook under the west window. There's an old pallet in the woodhouse. Air it. Don't bring mice in with it." And he stalked off towards the Overfell, angry with the boy for coming and with himself for giving in. But it wasn't anger that made his heart pound. Striding along, he could stride then, with the sea wind pushing at him always from the left, and the early sunlight on the sea out past the vast shadow of the mountain, he thought of the mages of Roke, the masters of the art magic, the professors of mystery and power. "He was too much for him, was he? And he'll be too much for me," he thought, and smiled. He was a peaceful man, but he didn't mind a bit of danger.